we try to do is to draw, to sketch out the implications for the trading system, which we know better than the climate change negotiations, but the implications arising for the trading system from the climate change negotiations. The key thing is not only do you have very complex sets of negotiations going on in parallel, but they both feed into each other. And we're interested particularly in how the climate change negotiations feed into the trade side.
So can you just unpack that for us? What are some of the issues that come out when you do these sort of comparisons?
Perhaps the best way of looking at it, and if you like, it's the lever that opens up this box, is the issue of so-called carbon leakage, which basically means that this is well understood in the climate change negotiations, that the developed countries have an historic responsibility. They have to move first, they have to move fastest. There's differentiated responsibilities, let's put it that way. But if they do that, if they put in place stringent climate control mechanisms in their own countries, cap and trade, for instance, in the European Union, they punish, if you like, their domestic producers, then there is a risk that those domestic producers relocate to other less environmentally stringent jurisdictions, like China, and particularly China. So you don't solve the global problem because the industries just relocate to China and export from China back to the European Union. But you do punish your own industries. And so that then creates a very real challenge in terms of trade and investment.
Why is the issue of intellectual property rights such a big thing, especially when it comes to discussing technology transfer?
Well, let's start with the issue of technology transfer. So basically, developed countries are saying to developing countries, you need to do something about climate change, and we'll give you the funding to support that. Developing countries are saying, well, it's not only a matter of funding, we also need access to those technologies so we can produce in a clean, environmentally friendly way. The problem is those technologies are primarily controlled by developed country companies. Hence, how do you manage that process of transferring the intellectual property rights, and there are intellectual property rights connected to this, from those developed country companies to developing country entities? And so obviously, if you're a developed country company and you've invested in these technologies, you own the intellectual property rights, you don't want to just give them away. But the global commons, if you like, suggests that those technologies do need to diffuse. So you need to find a balance between the individual company's rights to hold on to the technology and the developing country's desire to access that technology. If the incentives are there for developed country companies to invest in developing countries and earn a decent return, then the investments will flow and the technologies will be transferred in time. So you've got to look at both sides of the equation. It cannot just be that developed countries must give everything to developing countries. That's never going to work. Instead, you need to reduce it to a core proposition, which is how do you get these technologies more widely diffused? How do you put the incentives in place? How do you provide the funding to support that? It's a whole package deal.
The book mentions that a lot of Southern African countries don't have solid climate change policies. How far behind are we as a region?
Well, in the climate change process, there are broadly two streams of issues. The first is what climate change policy wonks would call mitigation. The second is adaptation. So let's start with mitigation. Mitigation basically means that, and particularly developed countries, but also large developing country emitters, have to find ways to reduce their carbon footprint. They have to mitigate their carbon footprint. For countries in Southern Africa, the problem really isn't mitigation, because we are not major generators of CO2 and other greenhouse gases. South Africa is, by the way, so South Africa is exceptional in Southern Africa. But for the rest of Southern Africa, pretty much, the problem is an adaptation one, primarily. So in other words, climate change takes place, weather patterns change, how do societies adapt to that changing weather system? But then what we looked at in the book is, as the developed countries now go for mitigation policies, they may throw up trade barriers to the region's exports. So we're also trying to draw that linkage. So the French and the German presidents have said, we are not prepared to put in place stringent mitigation systems, cap-and-trade schemes, if our industries are just going to shift offshore and continue to produce and emit, and potentially emit more in countries like China, India, South Africa, and so on. And in order to prevent that, what we propose is to put in place so-called carbon tariffs. So fine, this industry relocates into China, exports back into the EU, but then we impose a cost at the border. And so it's a punitive measure and it's designed to prevent that problem. That way it becomes a trade issue. Because now what is the legality of putting in place a carbon tax measure? Well, ultimately it will find its way back into the WTO because the Chinese, for instance, would challenge it. Where do they challenge it? So the question of jurisdiction becomes a critical question. So the problem with the climate change negotiations and why everybody's so interested in the WTO is that the UNFCCC process does not foresee a binding dispute settlement mechanism. There's no court you can go to settle your disputes. But there is one in the WTO. So it's binding dispute settlement. So that becomes very attractive.
The book looks at four case studies in Southern Africa, Botswana, Mozambique, Zambia, and South Africa. Could you take us through some of the big policy issues we should be looking at?
Yeah, basically we wanted to get a sense of what, or do these countries face any mitigation challenges? And then what is the nature of the adaptation challenge in each case? So in the case of South Africa, clearly there is a big mitigation problem. South Africa is a major emitter, and that's the primary source of the problem, so to speak. Adaptation is much less of an issue because we have a relatively capable state, a relatively well-funded state. In Botswana's case, again, the state capacity is quite good. Funding's not so much of an issue, but there's a lot of desert in Botswana. Adaptation could be a challenge for them. And on the mitigation side, in terms of their energy mix, they are going to be relying increasingly on coal, which is a major source of energy emissions. So at some point down the line, they may face a mitigation problem. But for Mozambique and Zambia, the other two countries we looked at, both are LDCs, least developed countries. Least developed countries should not be obliged to mitigate because they're very minor sources of greenhouse gases. So for Mozambique and Zambia, the problem really is an adaptation one. And in the Mozambican case, it's a pretty serious one if you think of cyclones, for instance. So if the climate change projections are accurate, the intensity and frequency of cyclones will increase, extreme weather events. Mozambique, very poor country, very difficult for it to cope with it. The last major cyclone that went through South Africa to throw in its air force and so on really help out. And then in the Zambian case, the real challenge for them is how their agricultural system will adapt to climate change, because agriculture is really the key driver of their economic growth.
The United Nations will be holding their Conference of Parties meeting in Cancun in Mexico at the end of November 2010. How do you see South Africa specifically as sort of the power in Africa positioning themselves at that meeting?
South Africa is in an interesting position because, as I mentioned, it has a big mitigation problem, whereas the rest of the continent pretty much doesn't. So in terms of alignment of interests, it's not really there. But South Africa wants to support the African group and African countries more generally in the negotiations. So it does fly an African flag. So it's positioning itself broadly in two camps. One is the so-called basic grouping, so Brazil, South Africa, India, and China primarily. And then on the other hand, it's positioning itself in the Africa grouping and beyond that, the G77, which is a much broader grouping of developing countries. And so it's trying to play in both camps, a very difficult balancing act to play.
What are you expecting from the upcoming UN conference in Cancun?
I don't think there will be a deal. The reason I think that is because of the recent elections in the United States. And those have put control of the Congress back into Republican hands, and Republicans are basically opposed to a climate change deal. So I think there's good luck on the US front, and if the US doesn't move, as we've seen in the WTO talks, nothing moves. So what then is likely to unfold in Cancun? Well, presumably progress in a whole range of working groups. So for instance, technology transfer, finance, and so on and so forth. And maybe incremental movement on certain issues, but I don't expect an overall breakthrough and big PhD or not this year. It's possible that will happen next year in South Africa, the key date being 2012 when a new deal has to be in place, but I'm not sure that that's going to be the case.